Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, we're back from our trip to Raleigh, North Carolina. Why don't you share a little bit about some of the highlights of that?
Well, that was a lot of fun, a little bit of a drive. It was a six-hour-plus drive, but then we took advantage of having an expanded staff, and we had one of our producers,
Warren. We have a driver now.
Yeah, both ways. Exactly. I thought that was cool. And we got chicken livers on the way up and chicken livers on the way back, so it was a victory for me.
That's right. Now, the event we were at was the CED Tech Ventures. It was their 29th annual event. It was a bunch of startups, a bunch of smart people.
It was. And 25 or 30 interviews in the space of 2 days, and there were folks with money, folks that needed money, and it's just so much fun to be around people in that crowd. They're passionate. They're optimistic. A lot of creative juices flowing, and a lot of IQ points walking that carpet. So those are always a lot of fun.
That's it. But today, we've got a big show in here.
Yes, we do. Georgia Society of CPAs has been kind enough to be working with us for the last several months, and every so often we set aside a special episode to talk to their premier members, and today's going to be no exception. We have with us for today's show John Masters and Joel Pascanner. How you doing, gentlemen?
We're doing fine, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the kind words.
Well, we are glad to have you back. So, Joel, it's been a little while since we've had you in the studio. What's been happening that we need to get caught up on in the land?
Did you figure out that Obamacare stuff yet?
Yeah, what's the skinny on that?
All basic stuff, no worries, and you know the land of accounting is always, and taxation, always very exciting.
Well, I've been counting on them doing away with it, so I want to stay ignorant as long as I can. And I'm doing a good job of it.
We'll need to get into it. I just was going to give a little plug, and before we start, I want to thank you guys again for having us. We're sort of semi-regulars here every other month, but as you all know, the Georgia Society of CPAs is the premier professional organization for CPAs, and we have over 13,000 members. And our goals really are to achieve excellence by providing superior advocacy, leadership service, lifelong learning, and personal and professional development opportunities. And that's part of the reason we're here, to share our knowledge, disseminate information, and educate your listeners and accountants out there.
So how long have you been a member of this Georgia Society of CPAs, Joel?
Well, I'm not a native Georgian. So I
really
wasn't,
that accent's yeah, not. I thought it was Smyrna. Wasn't Smyrna?
Well, no. Originally, I'm you know, from the South. No, I'm from New York. So I was a member actually in New York Society of CPAs for a number of years. I've been here for about 16 years, and I have been a member since I've been here. John is a
so all that was to apologize for being a member for only 16 years. Is that what that whole setup was for?
Yeah, it's sort of a guilt.
Well, you've been on the tax section then ever since you've lived here, right?
Well, the first thing I did when I moved in, really, I didn't get a house or an apartment. I just flew in. I went straight to the society.
Well, man's got
to
have his priorities.
Yeah, like most people, that's how we.
But this organization, in all seriousness, this organization is that type of an organization that you would. That's a priority. Become a member and kind of integrate yourself into the CPA world here in Georgia.
Absolutely. I mean, John, I think you've been a member for late 40s. but it's been, I know, much longer.
Did you mean 940?
Yes. Well, this morning.
1980, I believe, is when I became a member.
But yes, it is the premium. You want to be a member, tremendous resources, and you know, think of a room of 13,000 CPAs.
Don't make me.
you've never seen so many shades.
How do you guys get along? Because don't you compete at some level, right? Or are you just, or is it so niched nowadays that you really don't compete so much? Or how does that piece work to have so many people from one profession and together like that?
Well, it's not a competitive. This organization is highly professional. I mean, I don't know if you're visualizing, you know, hand-to-hand combat. Or, you know, we're not by nature, a warlike group. We're you know, very gentle, kind and gentle. But I mean, there certainly is always competition, you know, in terms of getting business. Mm-hmm. But this is more of a community professional type organization where we're sharing ideas, experiences. John and I were even talking about IRS experiences and learning different things. And yes, you're right. There are dozens upon dozens of niches. There are various sections, but this has become so niche-y and specialized. It's
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about that, when I was 38, that's been a couple of days ago, I heard about it.
Yeah.
I heard there's a study done, and I don't remember too much about it, but I heard about it on the radio on the way home one day, and it said that to be a doctor, a physician, it required 20 formal years of education to understand the body of knowledge. That seems low now. But to become a tax attorney, it took 41 years. I said, well, no wonder I don't understand enough. I'm not even old enough to do this job.
It's not your fault.
Right. You're just getting in there. Oh, say,
so,
go ahead.
Well, so I was going to say, so the niches, there's so much out there, and everybody has tax issues. So there's a lot of clients, and we don't have any fist fights except over who's right. You know, that's always.
Yeah.
So I've got a ton of questions, and one of them is there's an upcoming deadline, and I know that because I haven't filed yet.
And Do you want to publicize that on radio?
Well, my accountant, or my current accountant, maybe I should say.
Did you bring your return, John? And I can we'll work on that here as you.
She told me we had till October the 15th, but it's coming. But it's coming.
No
up,
sweat.
Right?
You got told. Most of these clients.
Yeah, come in the week before. Yeah, day before.
He's got to get a new shoebox. Then he'll head over there.
Yeah. So, are there any last minute moves that I ought to be talking to her about?
Or is it too late?
Is it too late? And it is what it is.
Well, it is. I mean, for the most part, it's too late. I mean, it's tough going back. Right. There's very little. I mean, the only things I can think of are if you are self-employed, if you are a partner in a partnership or a member in an LLC, and you generate self-employment income. That's your job. You get a 1099. You're a director. You still have time to set up a retirement plan by October 15th. You can set up a SEP. It's called a SEP. And I'm looking at you, but I'm not necessarily addressing this to you. I'm not sure you have this or if you do. But if you were a partner in a CPA firm or in some other organization and you got income, you could go in by the you can make that contribution. Take that deduction on your 2012 return.
And that's one thing you can do. Also, another thing that's out there, if you happen to be self-employed and you have a loss this year, which sometimes people do, then you do have a choice on your return about whether to carry the loss back and file for a refund from prior years or going forward only, which can be a significant decision. If you don't make the election, then the default is that you have to go back, and that can be a good thing. But it's simpler to go forward only.
Now, isn't that one of the biggest values of having a really good CPA that's not somebody that you're just handing them a box of receipts and saying, go and fill in the blanks of something, that you're having these kind of conversations throughout the year so you can strategically make the right move, right?
Well, that can be, and particularly this time of year, planning for next year is one of those things that, well, you kind of got to wait till you know what Congress is doing to do that seriously. And so you need to be following that right up to the last minute. In fact, last year they didn't pass the tax law and didn't sign it into law until January the 3rd of this year.
Good Lord.
So they did go and say that was retroactive, too.
And that was nice of them to do that.
Retroactive?
That was very generous.
That's awful.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the thing is you have to pay attention to that stuff. And at the end of the year is a good time to look at doing things like whether you can defer income if you want to because of a difference in your tax situation from one year to the next.
So now, what are the conversations you have with your clients to kind of prepare them so they can be proactive and not miss out on things but also take advantage of things? Like, are you meeting with them quarterly? Are you meeting with them annually? What's the rhythm of that?
I think it varies. Certainly, I know John and I somewhat similar practices. You like a lot of communication.
Right.
You know, to say quarterly, we do a lot of conversations, call back and forth, so you want to know what's going on. And as John was saying, this is a good time between now and now we're awfully busy, but say after October 15th
at the
end of the year, to do planning for this year. And this is a tough year because we've got the Obamacare, tax rates have gone up, capital gain rates have gone up. One other thing I was just going to throw out, which does sort of dovetails with John and Stone were asking about for 2012 and prospectively and retrospectively, as you know, about a month ago, the Supreme Court invalidated certain parts of the divorce of the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA. And as a result, same-sex marriage partners can now file joint tax returns. That's really the upshot in terms of taxation.
Right. And how far back does that go?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly, if we're doing 12 returns, they can, and you haven't filed your 12 return, they can file jointly. This all, regardless of where they are domiciled or where they reside, whatever state, if they have been married in one of the celebration states, there are 13 states and I think the D.C., they can file jointly or married filing separately for 2012. They can also go back and for as long as the statute of limitation is open and consider doing that. And you also would have to consider that for 2013. And then that's
do they have to go back?
No,
or
they
is
don't.
That a choice?
No, they don't. They don't have to go back. But that was an open question until just recently. I think the ruling was just in the last 10 days or so. About whether you could do that. You know, we were saying, well, if we don't know, then you need to file a protective claim just to preserve the right to go back in case they say we can. So anyway, they did, and so you can look at it and decide whether or not you want to go back or not. You don't have to, but you can file a joint return if you have previously filed separate returns. If you're married, you have two choices, married filing separate, married filing jointly.
Right.
Well, until this year, then anyone that would in the gay community that were married or wanted to be married, they didn't really have a choice. They could only file single. Well, now they can look back and say, well, would it have been advantageous? And if it would have been advantageous to file within the preceding 3 years, they can now go back and file for up to 3 years and potentially get a refund for those years. And that's something that...
Right, because they wouldn't change it unless it was beneficial to them.
Right. So, you know, and the same rules effectively apply to everybody now. So, and generally, if you both make about the same income, you're both working, well, then chances are somewhere between slim and none that it would be advantageous to go back and do it. But if one's working and the other is not, in that case, then you almost certainly would benefit from filing, going back and filing amended returns. So by October 15th, at least you will have lost a year if you don't do something on that oldest year by that time. So that's one of the year-end things that is still out there that can be done.
You guys are never going to be out of work, are you? I mean, there's always going to be stuff like this every year.
You know,
it's going to change.
We don't understand why the unemployment rate is what it is. I mean, you know, they just keep giving us more work.
It just never stops. And, you know, as you were saying, Lee, sort of the wild card with this, the uncertainty issue is there is uncertainty about state taxation.
Yes.
Right.
Which I don't even really want to go into, but for federal, we are talking about possible, you know, filing status for these, you know, individuals affected by this, but we don't, you know, some states obviously are, you know, don't comply with this, so they don't necessarily buy into the joint or filing separately when you're married. So there are questions there.
Now, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about IRAs. There was with the economic downturn, a lot of people were tapping their IRA maybe earlier than they would have liked, or they're maybe even using the funds for different things. You know, maybe there's an opportunity that's their only liquid asset that they can get a hold of. So they, I know you, Stone, you were thinking about.
Well, yeah, I've got a half a dozen IRA.
Right. So like,
no, I tapped my IRA to pay for some college.
Right. So what's the deal with the penalties, and is there anything you can do to avoid them? How's that work?
Well, there are limited exceptions to, well.
What if I have to pay for like a gay marriage? Can I write that off? Can I use my IRA?
I don't believe I saw that in the code anymore.
I don't know. I might be confusing the two.
That might be considered.
That's
an aggressive
on the legislative
tax
agenda
position.
Next year, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's aggressive.
Well, you I don't remember all the exceptions.
That's not one.
Yeah.
Now, what? How does that work? Like, you know, a lot of people, because they don't have the cash anymore, they can't get the equity from their house anymore, so they go to their IRA, you know, maybe to invest in a franchise or something, and they're taking this out. So what's the penalties for that? What price do they have to pay for this?
If it's a medical expense, then that would be one of the reasons why you could take money out and not pay the penalty. It'll still be subject to the tax.
Right.
But they're limited.
Limited. But the ones you're pointing out are good ones.
Education,
yeah. Medical, particularly medical if you're unemployed. There is very few others. I think there is one for first-time home buyer, which right. you mentioned. Those are the major ones, but there have been actually.
I can tell you right now, I give you a very specific situation. My wife, she has a real job, right? She's built up a pretty nice 401k by our standards, and I've watched it swing, you know, like a $15,000 up and down every 3 or 4 months.
Other story, yeah.
So while I'm watching it swing up and down, I'm feeling like if that was real money and I really, really could do what I wanted to with it, then the next time it took a $15,000 swing, I'd take five of it and I'd knock out this credit card and be done with it. But now they're going to pop me hard if I do that.
Right. Right. I would say, I mean, this is just my opinion. If you have a child and you have college costs, maybe you could take. I'm talking, you know, first of all, we're talking more like people who need that money desperately. But
right.
But if you took that money and you had college tuition for a child yourself or your wife that was, say, equal to or exceeded the amount you were taking out, because money's fungible, you may be able to claim, despite the fact that you didn't maybe directly use it for that, indirectly you did.
Right. Take that and throw it in the education account, and then just what I was going to go throw it toward education, go pay the card off.
Well, I'm not saying that, but I don't want to say
on
that.
On the record, no,
the best thing is to take the money and pay the tuition, but I think you'd make a very good argument if you said, hey, you know, the tuition was more than this. And
right.
So, but we're talking about the penalty only.
So then we still got to pay the tax for
the
penalty.
The tax. The penalty's bad, though. You know.
But okay, so you're saying that if I use it for education, I don't pay the penalty, or that's one of the excuses?
That's one of the exceptions.
Is education, medical, and what was the third one?
First-time home buyer. Right. A lot of people do that to put their down payment.
Right. And you know, sometimes if you have something come up, it's good to check the individual thing. Sometimes there are court cases that come out that don't make the news right away, but they're there. So you can check for things like that if it's important. But don't forget, if you've taken money out and you can put it back in within 60 days, then you can do that without having to pay the penalty or the tax.
Oh, so you can use it as kind of like a bridge loan?
You could do that. Now, I consider that fairly dangerous thing to do, but, you know, because people forget and they lose track of time.
Right.
But I'd rather risk, you know, what is it, 10% penalty than my kneecaps, right? If it's a short-term
good point.
You know, we try to avoid veto at all times.
Now, did you say a few moments ago capital gains tax has gone up as well?
Yeah, and that will probably affect you. Maybe or others. Yeah, the capital tax rates are going up, and they have gone up.
It was
15. It was 15. It's now 20. If you are in a tax bracket, if you're in the highest tax bracket, we now have a new tax bracket.
Now we're talking to Lee. Now you can start addressing Lee. Highest
okay,
tax
I won't look at you anymore. Okay, you had various tax brackets.
Right.
Okay. Now we now have a new tax bracket for joint taxpayers. I believe it's over $450,000 of taxable income. So now I'm looking over at Lee.
Yes.
Okay. And it's 39.6%, the highest bracket before.
That's
was
35. Fantastic.
So that's good news.
Yes.
Because you want to.
I want to help.
You want to help. You're a good American. You're a great American. So we have that. And then in addition, the long-term capital gains were taxed at 15%. If you're in that high bracket, your long-term capital gains are going to be taxed at 20%. So you got a big rise there, and then you mentioned before, Lee, the Obamacare, which isn't it. So you got a lot more taxes.
It starts adding up to real money.
Yeah,
yeah, you're going to be paying taxes now.
What was that Humphrey that said that? Back then he said a million here and a million there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Exactly.
I would say it's billions, you know.
But all these rates have gone up, and they do provide for planning opportunities, because if you could try to do so, maybe you want to talk to a client this year. I have a client who said he was going to reconfigure his portfolio with his investment banker, investment broker. And he had, I don't know exactly what he was doing, he was just changing the allocations, or he had something like 150, 250 stocks and he was going to cut them back. The result was he was going to generate a lot of capital gains. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you're saying there's a lot of movement, there's been a lot of gains in there. So trying to give some thought as to maybe a way of deferring or spreading out these gains so that we don't jump them into this 20% bracket. You know, try to keep them out of that highest bracket. Maybe we can get the capital gains or the preponderance of capital gains tax at a lower rate. So doing some planning there.
Now, how do you work with a client that's in that kind of a situation? Because the investment, the broker is like, yeah, make the trade, right? Because they want to make the trade. And then you're like, man, maybe you shouldn't make the trade because you're going to get hit with these taxes. How do you work together so that you're all on the same page?
Yeah, sometimes you can work together and sometimes you really don't. But
and you're just like cleaning it up after the fact, like after they make some sort of a trade, and you're like, man, what? If
that
you
one's a tough to clean up, but
yeah,
but it does.
But there's you can work with brokers but it's a cooperative thing. And but a lot of times the commissions today, especially if it's a discount broker, you don't really have a broker. Mm-hmm. It's up to the individual. The commissions themselves are low, and it's not a significant factor. But with a full major broker, then the commissions would still be worth considering.
But couldn't they, like, if they're not taking the tax ramifications, and if they're not looking at that, and they're just looking at, oh, I'm going to have this gain here, and then all of a sudden they get hit with 20%, you know, capital gains tax, it could negate the gain.
Well, there are a number of things you could get into. One is if you have a lot of gains, you could look at setting up a charitable remainder trust and do something.
Would have to know ahead of time, right?
And that's a tough one. In this particular situation, it's a good situation for us because this is a taxpayer who has his investment advisor and his CPA, and probably his attorney as well, all on the same page. So when he does something, and I'm just sort of urging you and others to do the same because the investment guy called, or they both called together, emailed, and they said, we're thinking of doing this.
What do you think?
What do you think? Right. Should we do it all in
one
shot?
Or if we're going to do it, maybe we should set up this charitable thing and, you know, there's strategies around it.
Yeah, you're asking how to clean it up. I mean, yeah, and John's idea is great, and if you have time, you find out at the end of the year, maybe you can generate losses, but
this is some of the year-end things, and a lot of these may take some time to actually set up, and they work. They work better in specific cases. It doesn't apply to everyone, and not everyone would want to do it. You know, it takes some time to do it.
But it's important, though, that you're all on the same page. That's the lesson here, right, is to get all of the trusted advisors all working together.
That is the lesson, communication and working together. Yeah, absolutely. Now, doesn't always happen.
Is there anything with the alternative minimum tax that we should know about?
Be careful.
Here, read this book.
The thing that I run into the most of the time on this is that people are thinking, well, I'll go buy a more expensive house because I get more tax deductions and so on. And I said, wait a minute. You know, don't forget about the alt-min tax because you're thinking the old way, which has been around, you know, for decades, but the alt-min tax is now effective for a lot of people. So you can't make a decision without considering the alt-min tax too. And people still aren't doing that like they should. That's another comment I was going to make, but I'm having a senior moment. I forgot.
That's all right. I got plenty of questions.
You go ahead, Storm.
Well, I wanted to bring up every time Mom and Dad come to town to visit, I've been trying to articulate to them this thing that I read on the internet, of course, so you know it's true, that they can give X number of dollars for Katie and Kelly to go to school without having to pay taxes on it. And I keep trying to have this conversation.
How come
this
is all about you and your college fund?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because not only can they give gifts to Kelly, they can give gifts to John and myself.
That's right.
Yeah, they can give gifts to everybody.
Why are you being so selfish with your parents' money?
Yeah, so this does relate to all of us in a way.
I'm giving these guys an opportunity to shine and demonstrate their expertise. But there's some truth to this, right?
We're jumping on. Yeah, there's something called I know we're jumping all over something called the gift tax. There's an estate and gift tax, and they're somehow tied together. But there is actually an annual exclusion of gifts that each individual can give to a recipient, a particular recipient, can be given to anybody. And there is a gift tax that could be imposed on the the giver, the one who gives, not the one who receives, because some people get confused.
Oh, I'm good then. Never mind.
Yeah, so let's just move on.
But there's no tax on the recipient.
There's no tax on the recipient, but they could end up
They can give you, if they give more than a certain amount. Your mother-in-law.
Yeah, the annual gift tax exclusion just means that gift does not have to be reported to anybody. It has to be a completed gift. You know, it's not a gift in trust, but a, you know, a cash gift to send your kid to school.
Like how much money are we talking about?
Up to $14,000 this year.
Per recipient.
That's a nice hit.
But you know, it's a good thing for you.
Yeah.
They can pay directly the tuition for your kids or the medical expenses of your kids, and it doesn't count towards that 14, leaving additional money to give to the kids and you guys.
Now
the big question here is how much have you got?
So we're thinking we're doing a lot of work for
so
you.
Then,
here.
Yeah. So then they could just write the check right to the
directly
college.
To the college.
That does not
doesn't count
as a gift, but then can they write off that
it's not
that
a we're sort of combining so income tax and gift tax. It's two different regimes.
Right.
So no, there's no write off, but they would those wouldn't be counted.
Right. So they can pay the tuition and give them $14,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See that?
Yeah.
You hear that, Mom?
Maybe you should just send her.
We're going to record this episode, Kevin, and ship it to Mom.
And they would want to do that because, as you relate to me, their estate is just huge.
Very large.
Right?
It's tremendous magnitude.
Look, they were
wanna,
teachers, so you know they're rolling.
Well, right off, yeah. Teachers, my parents were teachers. I know that. So they would want to, that's not the right word, deplete, but sort of, you know, minimize their estate tax when they die. So they would want to. You should speak to them. They should definitely enthusiastically want a gift.
And this is a certified public accountant talking, Mom. This is not some guy that brought in here.
But
all right. So is there any – okay, so we covered the gift tax.
We covered gift tax.
We touched on the alternative minimum tax. Did we miss anything in that?
Yeah, the K-1s came out late. What's that about? Because you and I do the K-1 thing, but we don't really know what we're doing. We just hand them to our –
Oh, you guys get the K. That's part of the reason we're in this bind here.
That's right.
And that the whole thing's convoluted, but the extended due date for the individual returns, the last date is October 15th.
Correct.
And that's because these K-1s, their last date to come out was
Monday.
Monday this week.
Oh,
and as you know, some of these come out on Monday. And that's why it holds up the individual returns, and they are some of them are voluminous and difficult.
Right. What do these calendars look like? Do you get a calendar every year with all these dates on it? How do you keep track of all this?
The dates are stayed fairly consistent. They've been modified a little bit lately to assist in this particular issue. So, but the 15th of every month, you just count
something
on this.
Something's going on.
Something's, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So what are the repercussions of this K-1, late K-1s?
Well, they're not necessarily you got to include them on your tax return. So now you got your K-1, you have until October 15th, assuming you got an extension, to file your personal return and still be timely.
And since it's September 19th, you have plenty of time.
Right. No problem.
Yeah.
And then you can start all over for next year.
Exactly.
Well, the problem with these K-1s, too, just like the 1099s you get, the IRS does match them. So that's why we try to get all the information, capture them.
They match them up to see if there's any hanky-panky?
They try to do that.
They're trying to help.
They try. I don't think that's a technical term they're using over there.
What, hanky-panky?
Is it? I don't know. Maybe that's in the vernacular now. But that's what they do, yeah. And they frequently send out matching notices, and things don't match. I'm sure maybe all you know it's not uncommon.
Or they count them twice.
Well, they'll double them up and they'll calculate your tax wrong. But you want to file a complete and accurate return, and that's why you want to capture those things, and that's part of the problem we're in terms of timing.
Now, is there anything I can do regarding donations? Like, how do I keep track of you know, you're on a board and you're donating a lot of time and money to an organization. Am I allowed to count the time I donate, or is it only the actual physical?
Negatory.
No, you can't
count your time. I mean, you know, if you're doing 20 years, well, maybe you can count.
Okay. So, but I can count the actual things I donate, right?
Like the cost.
That. But the how come not time?
Well, the rules allow you to deduct only your cash expenses, actually, or equivalent completed gifts that are for charitable contributions. A big trick, though, is you have to get a proper receipt. Now, that is still not being done properly by a lot of charitable organizations.
Like Goodwill, I don't want to say Goodwill. There's some of these type Goodwill type organizations that they'll just
Salvation
go, you need
Army,
right
Goodwill,
here. Yeah. Here's a blank, you know, and then you just fill out whatever you want.
Well, that poses
some. We're okay with that.
That poses some issues, but I'm thinking more in terms of a check to a college for $5,000, and you say, "Well, okay, where's your receipt? I don't have a receipt."
The check's not the receipt?
You don't, no. The check is not the receipt.
Uh-huh.
If it's over $250, thou shalt get a receipt.
That's one of the commandments. It was on the back, I think.
Well, the American kids are...
And not only that. Not only that. It has to be a receipt that says you got nothing in return, or if you got something in return, it tells you how much you got in return and how much is deductible. And there... There've been some bad case decisions lately on that point.
But what defines nothing in return? What if they put my name on a, you know, on a?
No, what I mean is it's quid pro quo. There is no quid pro quo. If you buy a $100 ticket to something and go and have dinner, and the dinner's worth, you know, $9.95.
So then
they got to tell you that.
They'll tell you on there usually.
They're supposed to tell you on that. But I see them where they've made significant contributions and they don't do that. And it's not deductible if you don't have that language on there. And I've read a couple of cases recently, one for like $1.7 million that was denied because of a faulty or late acquired
receipt.
Yes.
Ouch.
So you have to have that when you file the return.
Wow. So they couldn't get out of that? So they just...
They went to court.
Wow.
I've had a couple of exams recently where they are asking for the charitable contribution. They ask for the check and the acknowledgement. And if you have, you know, one without the other, I mean...
But why isn't the check good enough?
Well, it's the way the law itself is written. Yeah. It's the documentation required. It's not really up to the IRS. That's the law. Mm-hmm. And so when you wind up with a large item that's in dispute, you look at what the law is on the point, and you have to comply or you lose. That's
exactly what did not have the acknowledgement on some of these.
But you donate $1 million, and then you're like, and they didn't give you a receipt, and then now your accountant's yelling at you, and you can't go back to them and say, hey, I need an invoice.
You have to do it before you file
before
the return.
You
have to get it done timely.
Okay. So, but you could say, hey, you better get a receipt, and then I can go get the receipt, and then it's still okay.
Well, I think as a preparer, I think we can say to you, hey, well, you've got this list, and do you have receipts?
We need documentation.
You better make sure you have
this.
Receipts, and we're going to deduct it. But, yeah, you need to get the receipt.
So I should give a shout-out, though, to the breast cancer folks. You know, we donated the last minivan that we had, and they
that
were...
That one with the blown engine?
Well, I mean, it had some things wrong with it, but they didn't just write off the bat, write a receipt. They waited till they fixed it up, sold it, and then wrote us a receipt for the fair market value.
Right,
and they were on
okay.
top of all of it.
There are
and
some kept, special rules with
vehicles.
They
were great.
They sound like they're
on top
of
it. Yeah, they communicated really well. They gave us a website to check in with, so those folks were great to work with.
They're doing it right.
There are many that are excellent.
Yeah. My comment was not by way of criticism, but by way of warning people who make contributions, just be sure you have to have the receipt and you have to get it timely.
Right.
And some organizations do not know how to do that properly.
Right.
We observe those kinds of things when we're doing people's returns. And if it's a significant contribution, normally, we don't really require people to show us the receipts, but if it's a significant item, you have to mention that to your client, you know, because they can only remedy a problem if they have one by the time they file the return in this case.
And it's in the best interest of the charity to tell them.
Yeah,
because how are they explaining it to that guy that he's not able to deduct that? That's not a good conversation.
He's not doing another 1.7 next year.
Right.
Well, and they're required to, and I believe on their tax return, might be an information return, it asks if they have complied with the acknowledgement requirements, and they want to answer that affirmatively.
I mean, a big point is that some of this stuff is complex, And, you know, it's not necessarily complex. We get blamed for a lot of it, but it's really not us. You know, we didn't do this.
Well, any individual thing isn't complex. It's just all of it in its totality that becomes complex.
Yeah, but you raise a good point, too. I don't want to really delve into it because it's not a great area, but when you give non-cash contributions, you do – it depends on where you go, but they give you a receipt. Sometimes I go and you take a receipt, you know. And obviously non-cash contributions, clothing, furniture, that kind of stuff is deductible.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, there's some subjectivity and in terms of value, but you do need a receipt.
Right.
And there is, I mean, I remember a number of years ago, a taxpayer bringing in lists and lists of clothing, you know, attached to the receipt. And you see, I went through it with her. I remember her getting examined. And I remember the agent looking at it, and he's saying, you know, you deducted her undergarments, you know, which I did. That's sort of our niche.
You were talking about specialties.
Talking about specialties.
Very valuable, right?
Yeah, but the agent pretty much said, you know, for having the gall to do that, I deducted like $8 or something per item. And said, I'm going to give it to you just for having the gall to do that, to deduct, you know, used undergarments. So
now, for our listeners, for our listeners that are turning 70 in 2013, is there anything that they should be aware of regarding their retirement plans?
They got to start taking money, right?
Well, you know what? When you're young, like the half-year birthday is always very big.
Yeah.
You know, when you have kids or when you're five and a half.
Really?
And then it sort of goes away. But when you get older.
We didn't speak in fractions where I was growing up.
No. Well, up north where I came from, they did. But when you get older, it starts again, that half year. It's very important. So when you can take distributions from a retirement plan between 59 and a half and 70 and a half. The idea is to not take it if you don't have to.
Right.
But when you're 70 and a half, you have to.
You go on a program where you're taking it in some sort of a rhythm and an amount? Right.
It's an amount, yeah, certain amount. And as you guys were talking before, there's a communication issue because I think there's a question. Get John's thoughts. I don't know. I'm always in the middle of this. Who's doing this? Is it the bank, the administrator, the investment advisor, the CPA? Because I have had situations where distributions were not made and should have been made.
Right.
And again, also there are penalties for not doing that, and they're severe, and it's hard to go, and you try to catch up and that kind of thing. But when you're 75, based on formula, tables, life expectancy, you must begin taking them out from all your retirement accounts. You may have more than one. One may be dealing with it, one may not. You can take it all from one and as opposed to the others. But it's an issue to address, and there are other specials. You can wait till the April after you're 70 and a half.
Man.
But you need to – and then I actually have a couple of – I had two women. I mean, they actually – very attractive women, elderly women. They were they would not disclose their age to me.
That's
some weird clients.
An adult lady.
I kept asking her, and she would say, "I'm you know, 50," and then the next time she said, "I'm 47," and I said, "You know, just tell me how old you are." She would do it, and eventually,
you know why we have 13,000 members?
I can see that.
Now, one of the things that you want to be careful about is if you don't take the first year's distribution. Then you have to take two distributions in the
mm-hmm.
next year. So that could be something you don't want to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It is another one of those year-end planning things, though, where you might say, well, would I be better taking it this year or taking it next year?
Right.
So so you do want to look at it and not accidentally skip a year and run into the penalties. Now, they're pretty good about waiving penalties where some error's been made like that, but it's still paperwork and – you know, something to have to deal with.
And then, it's a percentage that has to be taken, or?
Yeah, it's based
the
on
the idea is that according to the actuarial table.
They want you to deplete it by the time
you're fully depleted, so is your money.
So they're going to time it exactly right.
But you can take out more than that. And, you know, at age 70 and a half, the life expectancy is something like 16, 17 years, something like that. I don't remember the exact number. So you can say, well, okay, I'll take out 10% a year if you want to. You can take out more. There's no penalty for taking out more just if you don't take out.
Can you take all of it out?
You can take all of it out if you want. No penalty, just taxes. So, and that's a good planning tool, too. If you have that option, then a thing to do is say, well, I have my retirement account over here, and I've got my stock market account, which is going up and down depending on Madoff's paperwork, profile. And so I'll take money out to match, to even out my cash flow each year, or look at the taxes and see what you need to do for based on this year. You can do that. It's a good planning vehicle to help minimize your overall taxes over time.
Yeah. I was going to say, I have a client also who actually he takes the required minimum distribution. I guess we calculate it. And he uses that. He doesn't make any, he's retired, he doesn't make any estimated tax payments during the year, and he has that tax withheld from his IRA distribution. He has the entire amount withheld as tax, and he doesn't, so he just doesn't make estimated payments. But they're different things.
So in his case, he, all of it goes to the government, right?
Yeah, the whole requirement distribution.
He retired to help the government.
Isn't that the idea?
That's the classic example, I guess, yeah.
All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground in this episode. If there's a CPA CPA out there that wants to learn more about the society, is there a website for you guys that they can go to a meeting, join you guys?
Yeah, the website address is
posted right under this audio on the webpage.
Georgia Society. Just Google Georgia Society of CPAs. That's probably a good start.
It's gscpa.org.
There you go. That's it. Nice you, save.
Not com, gscpa.org.
And then any individual that's thinking of hiring a CPA, you have to hire one that's in the Georgia Society of CPAs, or don't even bother, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the premier.
Well, because then you know they're serious about their profession.
Right, and that's a good starting place, but you really ought to have a conversation, because I get the sense you got to have this chemistry. You got to have a good relationship with solid communication, somebody you can click with and that will be that quarterback for you, maybe help coordinate the relationships with the other players in your financial planning.
I think communication, particularly in this arena, is important, and in any arena, yeah, I think it's key, and we've all had experiences with poor communication. That's when errors are made, and you try to clean up mistakes, and it's too late.
Yeah, I like to have people, you know, if they're going to do something significant, that they say, hey, I was thinking about doing this. You got any thoughts on that? And, you know, then usually I will. And that's a lot better than they say, hey, I did so-and-so. That's not going to cost me anything, is it?
That's not a good comment.
Better to mention anything you're thinking of doing to your accountant. You know, he can point you in the right direction if he doesn't know the answer.
All right. Well, we appreciate you guys coming on the show. Why don't we give you guys a chance to talk just your website for your individual practices. Joel, you want to share your website?
Sure. I work for a firm, Stephen M. Berman & Associates. We're in Buckhead, and we handle a wide variety of work. We're pretty
a wide variety. We've already established that.
Yeah, well, just
ladies' underwear.
Well, I'm not going to go into our areas of expertise, but yeah, and our website is www.bermanllc.com, and we're happy to help you if necessary.
And John?
Well, my website is johnmasterscpa.com. Real complicated.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spend a good bit of time representing people who forget to file and forget to pay. And we do, you know, tax
returns
and accounting.
You clean up people's messes.
Cleaner. Yeah. I don't know that I want to be called a cleaner. But
he's like the wolf in Pulp Fiction,
that's
right?
He fixes.
There you go.
It's a fixer.
Analogy, yeah.
Well, we do a lot of that.
Well, we appreciate you guys both being here, and we appreciate the Georgia Society of CPAs for having this regular episode to inform our listeners about all the important things that you got to pay attention to. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.